Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Mary, and I'll be hosting today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of Robert H. Hinckley and the Noble Foundation. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics, the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to all students here at the U, locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door to our office or to our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Realizing the Dream, Equality for All. I'll now introduce you to Judge Vernice Treece. Judge Treece was appointed to the 3rd District Court in November of 2006 by Governor John Huntsman, Jr. Judge Treece graduated with a Bachelor's of Arts in International Relations from Lewis and Clark College and received a law degree from the University of Utah College of Law. Prior to her appointment on the bench, Judge Treece served at the community of Salt Lake County as a senior trial attorney, capital qualified attorney, and assistant director with the Salt Lake Legal Defender Association. She's a recipient of the Utah Minority Bar Association Community Service Award. Judge Treece has served as a member of the Utah Commission on Racial and Ethnic Fairness in Criminal and the Juvenile Justice System and the State of Utah Office on Domestic and Sexual Violence, Domestic Violence Justice Planning Group. Judge Treece currently serves on the Supreme Court's Advisory Committee on the Rules of Criminal Procedure, the Judicial Council's Fine Bail Schedule Standing Committee, and is the chairperson of the Judicial Council's Court Interpreter Standing Committee. She is the National Association of Women Judges and is a member of the David K. Watkiss Sutherland II Inns of Court. Please join me in welcoming Judge Vernice Treece.
I'd like to introduce the Law Day panel members that we have here today. First, Judge William Thorne. Judge Thorne was appointed to the Court of Appeals, the Utah Court of Appeals, in May 2000 by Governor Levin. He was a judge in the Third Circuit Court for 8 years and served in the Third District Court for 6 years. Judge Thorne received his Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Santa Clara in 1974 and a JD from Stanford Law School in 1977. Judge Thorne has served as a tribal court judge in Utah, Idaho, Montana, New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona, Wisconsin, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Michigan. He is the former president of the National Indian Justice Center and a member of the board of directors for the court-appointed special advocates. He is a member of the board of directors for the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute, and a member of the ABA Steering Committee on the Unmet Legal Needs of Children. Grace Acosta. Sylvia Grace Acosta is a lawyer experienced in trial, arbitration, and mediation. She is a partner at the law firm of Scaley, Reading, Bates, Hansen, and Rasmussen. Grace served as president of the Utah Minority Bar Association from 2009 to 2010 and previously sat as an ex officio member of Utah Bar Commission. She is a former law clerk to Judge Thorne and is a former law clerk to the Honorable John Wright of the Nebraska Supreme Court. Grace graduated in 1994 from Auburn University with a Bachelor of Arts in both psychology and English and received her Juris Doctorate degree in 1997 from the University of Nebraska, graduating with academic honors. Grace is a judge pro temp and hears small claims cases in the Salt Lake City Small Claims Court, and she sits on the Career Development Committee for the Women Lawyers of Utah and is a member of the Leadership Utah 2013 class. Jesse Nix is a public defender with the Salt Lake Legal Defender Association and president of the Utah Minority Bar Association. Jesse graduated from the University of Utah with both a political science and law degree. He is a former Hinckley intern and is active on various community boards, such as the Young Alumni Association for the J.S. Quinney College of Law and the Utah Pride Center, a nonprofit based in Salt Lake City serving Utah's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. His passion for minority issues comes from his mother, who immigrated to Utah from El Salvador to escape a violent civil war, and his grandfather, a revolutionary in Honduras, who was jailed and forced to flee his home for his political beliefs. In his spare time, Jesse enjoys hiking in southern Utah, twilight concerts at Pioneer Park, and getting yelled at by the police officers. That's what he wanted me to read. Okay. So I welcome our panel members and thank them for their contribution today. The first question is to all panel members, and that is as follows. Law Day was proclaimed in 1958 by President Eisenhower to celebrate and honor the rule of law and to underscore how the law and legal processes have contributed to American freedoms, with an emphasis on the role of the courts in our democracy. 3 years later, Congress passed a joint resolution establishing May 1st as Law Day. This resolution states in part that May 1st is, quote, a special day of celebration by the American people in appreciation of their liberties and rededication to the ideas of equality and justice under the law, unquote. This year's theme is Realizing the Dream, Equality for All. In what ways have we today realized the dream of equality for all, number one? And secondly, are there areas of inequality that are still distant dreams that need changing? And if nobody is going to jump in, I'll start with Judge Thorne. Judge Thorne, in what ways have we today realized the dream of equality for all, and are there areas of inequality that are still distant dreams that need changing?
Well, in the sense that there's acceptance that equality ought to be the end result of our efforts, I think that's been achieved. But I think there's a long way to go to achieve reality inequality. I think it's all you have to do is look at the debates that are going on in this country. You can look at the statistics for placement. You can look at the numbers for average income. You can look at the unemployment rates. Equality has a long way to go. But I think, at least I hope, there's consensus that that is a goal. And I'm not sure that 50 years ago, when this came up, that that was an acknowledged goal.
Thank you. Grace?
I concur with Judge Thorne's thoughts that there has been progress. We can't say there hasn't been. I mean, the fact that women are sitting in this classroom today, the fact that I have a law degree, the fact that my parents migrated from this country, I'm a first-generation American, and I'm able to have a good-paying job and gone to a state institution and of higher learning and got degrees, we have made strides. But I think the key thing is that we can't forget that there's so many people that have been left behind that we need to listen to and learn from our previous experiences. I think the areas where we need to recognize is that we've only begun. First of all, I think identifying the problem is the first step toward resolution. But the next step is coming up with a viable solution to the problem, which I think is more problematic, more complicated, is still being worked out. So I think we still need to recognize women rights, gay rights, that there are inequalities in the workplace for people of different socioeconomic backgrounds, and that people are treated differently, whether it's in the court systems, in their jobs, in their everyday lives. So we can't ignore that.
And no, we have not achieved equality at all. It is something that I see every day in my role as a public defender in the justice and district courts. We have not seen equality based on income. We haven't seen equality based on race, on gender. We have a huge equality problem in this nation. My equality depends on everyone else's equality. And when I see injustice every day, it makes me feel, and it confirms my belief that we are not an equal country. When we have people, when people are poor, those people are not equal. In this country, it is much easier, it's much easier to be rich in the criminal justice system. It's much easier to be rich and guilty than poor and innocent. And that is a travesty. We have these Law Day things, and I think they're a great idea. I'm not one to celebrate our you know, our progress. I'm one to criticize what we haven't achieved yet. And, you know, that's what I think all of us should be doing, because we are not equal until every one of us is equal.
Thank you. As a follow-up on that, let me ask the following question. The issue of the courts have been brought up, and the courts play an integral role in maintaining the rule of law, which is one of the elements of Law Day. In a democracy such as ours, sometimes the rule of law protects and benefits the minority rather than the majority. How does the minority benefit when the majority are protected by the rule of law?
I think that anticipates that power control is going to ebb and flow from group to group. And the only way that you can protect yourself is to protect the person who's least powerful, who has the least amount of resources, because at some point, the situation will change. It may not be in my lifetime, but it will certainly be in my grandchildren's lifetime that things will change. And I want to make sure that they have a fair opportunity. All we have to do is look at some of the countries recently that have encountered revolution, where the majority has taken back power from the minority. Look at Syria. Look at Egypt. And you can see that already there are worries about smaller groups gaining control again, disenfranchising groups. I think ultimately our own protection comes from protecting the least among us.
And I think Justin is correct as well. I often look at this, the people that are the greatest leaders are those persons that can see the greater good, see that as a society there may be, I may be in power today, I may lose power tomorrow, but I need to figure out in the long run what is going to benefit us as a group. And I think that the court system, when it takes in consideration that every person should have equal footing, even though some of the limitations that Jesse had just mentioned may be there, equal footing before the law, they understand that sometimes you may be the powerful, sometimes you may be the weak, but it's supposed to equalize that. I had a discussion with someone the other day about criminal lawyers, and I do very minor criminal law, you know, DUIs, kids who get in trouble, and they said, how, I don't understand how someone can represent someone that's incorrect or that has broken the law, maybe murdered someone, molested a child. And I always said, well, I always think to myself is that I'm not protecting that person, I'm protecting the Constitution. I'm protecting the rights for all of us one day to have a fair trial, to force the government to prove their case, to defend, to make them prove their case before they take away my civil liberties. So I think if you consider that as the goal, which is to help all of us, not just to help the individual, then the majority-minority problem, if you will, goes away.
You know, and I don't think we're ever going to get rid of that majority-minority problem. So, you know, in a democracy, the Constitution is supposed to protect the rights of the minorities. But the problem is that the way our democracy works here in Utah, there's a predominant, and in the nation, there is a predominant majority here, white Americans. I'm half white. My dad's white. So I'm not preaching against white Americans. But they are the ones that control the system, and they're the ones that control the judicial system. They're the ones that control who gets appointed on the courts. Our legislature is overwhelmingly Republican. And so, you know, we're talking about defending the rights of the minorities. Well, it's hard to defend the rights of minorities when the legislature is overwhelmingly Republican. The governor does not appoint minority judges or any, you know. So, yes, we have this system that the courts are supposed to protect the minorities, but I think that, you know, we failed in that. I don't think the courts have protected the rights of minorities in the way that the way they should.
And I disagree with him on some level, I'll be honest.
Good.
With you. Yeah, sure, of course, that's why we're friends, Desi. I think the courts do work. They work to a majority of cases. I mean, I do most civil law, which I consider the reallocation of wealth between one person to another person, and it works civilly in every day. I mean, we're resolving disputes that involve either a small amount of money or a large amount of money, can involve children, I do family law too, the households, and it works. It helps resolve all those disputes in a civilized way. And so while there may be shortcomings, I think it works as a general principle. And I can't imagine any other way to resolve it.
And I think maybe with money, it is fair. But when you take, you know, we have the civil system and a criminal justice system. The criminal justice system is broken. And, you know, it's nice to say, well, we have these laws, people break them, they need to be punished, and the court is there to supervise. Well, what if the law is wrong? And the court is just a cog in the system from the Democratic, the legislative, the democratically elected legislature that now has made the court, rather than an independent judiciary, has made it just a cog in the system. And I don't mean to insult the judges on our panel. I am not talking about them. I'm talking about the system as a whole, that when we have unjust laws passed by the legislature, that they create this system of inequality. Our massive drug incarceration, that is creating massive inequality among minorities. You know, what, black men between the ages of 18 and 30, one in three has been incarcerated in their lifetime. You know, the violent crime rate has stayed pretty steady, but the drug rate crime has vastly gone up. In the 1970s, we only incarcerated about 700,000 people, less than a million. Today, that number is around 2.3 million people. We incarcerate more people than lots of other countries, similar to North Korea. I mean, that is a travesty. And so when we talk about how the court system is helping, you know, gain equality for minorities or helping the minorities keep the status, you know, keep up with majorities, they're not.
But isn't the court supposed to be one leg of a three-legged stool?
They are, but I don't think they stand on their own leg.
Okay.
I think things are improving. They're clearly not where they ought to be. But if you look back where things were 50 years ago, you can see a profound difference.
Yeah.
The mistake would be to think that that difference is an accomplishment. It's a process. And as long as there are young firebrands who are willing to stand up and say, no, the emperor has no clothes, we'll continue to make progress.
Yeah.
Has progress been too slow? Absolutely. But there is progress. When I started my judicial career 30-some years ago, I mean, there were two minority judges in the whole state, and we were in the same two-judge courthouse in West Valley. I mean, things are better. Are they where they need to be? Absolutely not. But it's progress. The trick, though, is to not rest on the laurels of what we've accomplished and to have somebody behind who's pushing and saying, it's not enough.
Judge Thorne, you are a prior chair of the Utah Commission on Racial and Ethnic Fairness in the Criminal and Juvenile Justice System, and today I understand you are a member of the Utah Courts Diversity Subcommittee. The Diversity Subcommittee and other committees and so forth that the court has currently are the court's response to the process that you have just commented about. Will you tell us a little bit about the committee and its goals? And then if you want to elaborate about other ways that the court has provided better access to minority communities today as opposed to in the past, I understand that the court has now a self-help center that provides forms and things of that nature to pro se litigants. The court interpreters program has expanded recently to include a provision to provide access to interpreters provided by the court in all cases, including civil cases. That was not the case before. So if you can talk a little bit about the diversity subcommittee and then any other committees and programs that the court has that you are aware of that has helped to provide better access to the minority communities.
Well, let me talk first in contrast to the Racial and Ethnic Fairness Commission. That was a group that was not just within the court, but was within the criminal justice system as a whole. And the goal was to first recognize the problem. We were not able to recognize a cause. We decided to leapfrog that issue, but to look at the results and then say, okay, what can the courts do? What can the police departments do? What can attorneys do? What can corrections do to try and fix the result? We were not able to achieve consensus on the cause because there were some of us who believed that racism is a part of the cause, and some who believed it was not. And we decided we were not going to resolve that issue. But we did reach unanimous agreement about the results that had to be corrected. The committee, the diversity committee that's currently in the courts, has as its target an attempt to engage minority communities and provide information. I don't think it's nearly enough, but it's something. I'm a little frustrated, and I've expressed that in some of those meetings, that I don't want to be in a position of reaching out to minority communities to hear their concerns and then say, I'm sorry that you have those concerns, but there's nothing I can do. I think that's a disservice. But to the extent that we can engage the communities and provide them with a better understanding of how the system works, so as members of the minority community encounter the system, they at least understand the roadmap, they understand some of the rules, and they know where they can go to get help. Jesse talked a little bit about some of the unfairness in the criminal system. But please don't be misled to think that it's only in the criminal system. All you have to do is look at the numbers of children who are removed from their parents. Utah removes four times as many Indian children, five times as many African-American children from their parents as white children. Now, there are certainly factors that play into that. Poverty, substance abuse, other kinds of things. But then that would seem to indicate that what we ought to do is be concentrating on helping those families rather than just removing. And it's not just in Utah. It's a nationwide problem. So, again, there are problems. But for anybody who wants to help, there are any number of places, of leverage points, where they can lend their efforts to try and make a difference.
Thank you. Does anybody else have a comment or anything about that? I asked the questions particularly to Judge Thorne because I knew he was a member of the subcommittee and then that he might have knowledge of the other resources that the court provides now and is in the process of providing to help address some of the issues that that the panelists have identified today.
I'll echo Judge Thorne's statement of the thing we need to be most focused on is rehabilitation and resources for individuals who get in trouble. If the state of Utah is taking children away from their parents, we need to fix the parents' problem. We need to get them the resources they need so they can get their children back. Because kids should be with their parents. They should not be with the state. And it's the same thing in the criminal justice system. Rather than punishing people for, if they're smoking pot, or meth, I'll use meth as an example here in Utah, the solution is not to incarcerate them. The solution is to get them the resources they need to fix their drug problem. And I think the courts are aware of this, and during sentencing, many judges require people who have been charged with drug, who have pled guilty or have been convicted of drug crimes, to get the substance abuse evaluation and treatment that they need. So I think right now there is more of a recognition that people need help more than punishment.
Thank you. Next question is, justice and equality for all is one of the goals of the DREAM. This year is the 50th year anniversary of the landmark case Gideon v. Wainwright, where the United States Supreme Court ruled that state courts are required under the 14th Amendment to provide counsel in criminal cases for defendants who are unable to pay for their own attorneys. What impact has the Gideon decision had in improving equality for all? And secondly, what can lawyers do to continue to improve the equality in representation of all defendants? Go ahead, Judge Thorne.
I was just going to say that before Gideon, people used to come into court with no help, and they were absolutely at the mercy of the system. And the system, like all systems, tried to become efficient. And that didn't mean protecting individual rights. That meant getting a conviction. Gideon, for the first time, said, to be fair, to truly be fair, somebody needs to be on the side of the defendant. Somebody needs to be a guide and a shield. Utah's use of public defenders varies tremendously. Unlike a lot of places, I happen to think that the public defender's office in Salt Lake County is first class. They're under-resourced, but they're vigorous, qualified advocates. Unfortunately, the further you get out from Salt Lake County, the quality goes down, in no small part because the counties fund that on a low-cost bid basis. And so you don't get the expertise, you don't get the continuation, you don't get the career people in that field, and you go to essentially a lowest bidder. The problem is even worse at the appellate level. Again, Salt Lake County public defenders do an outstanding job on their appeals, just like the Attorney General's office does. But when you get out of Salt Lake County, the quality suffers. Sometimes those attorneys have a flat rate basis, which means that they get paid the same amount no matter how much work they do or they don't do. There's currently a committee in process to try and remedy that problem, and that's going to require an influx of a lot of resources. But in the sense that Salt Lake County is, in my mind, well ahead of major metropolitan areas in the country, where the word is basically true that public defenders are barely better than nothing. Here in Salt Lake County, that's not true. They are excellent, but they're under-resourced and they're not available in outlying areas.
Yeah, this morning on NPR, they actually had a discussion about the sequestration effect on the federal defenders and how they were losing, having to fire people, and actually one of the directors decided to terminate himself rather than lose some of his subordinates who had moved to an area and weren't licensed to practice in that state. So, and I think one of the most important things he said was the right to an attorney in a criminal matter is not an extra. It is a constitutional guarantee. And if you make it a constitutional guarantee, then you have to provide it competently. And so if you don't fund it, it's not going to work. And that's my biggest concern with public defenders, is that they don't have enough money. And, I mean, you have talent like Jesse that goes there out of the goodness of his heart. But, you know, he's not going to be there forever. He'll do his time, and then he'll move on because he can make more money somewhere else. That's just the realities of it. And so you train people, and then they go on. And so it's a brain drain to a large degree.
I may stay at the public defender's office. It's the greatest job I've ever had. So don't say that. I think if Gideon were alive today, he would say he would want to go up to the Utah State Legislature. And he would want to say this. Utah, you guys are one of two states that don't have state funding for public defenders. You and Pennsylvania. 48 states fund their public defender's office, you know, from state funds. Gideon would say to the state legislature, especially in this last legislative session, please read Gideon v. Wainwright, and please read what it says. Because the Utah State Legislature in the 2013 session, a Republican tried to have a bill that basically said anyone in Utah who cannot afford an attorney will be provided one, if the possible punishment is jail time. There's some history, there's some background that I'm not going to tell you about, and you can research it yourself about what some other courts outside of Salt Lake have been doing. But the bill was just to say if you are going to be charged with a crime that has jail time, you get an attorney. Well, the Utah State Legislature voted down that bill, and it was a Republican sponsor, and during the floor debate, another Republican got up and said, how much is this going to cost? And the fiscal note attached to it was about $15 million, and then it was taken away. It doesn't matter about that. But the fact that this legislator got up and said, it's going to cost too much money. This money is going to come from the taxpayers. We cannot afford to fund public defenders on the dime of the taxpayers. If Gideon heard that, he would say, have you read the decision? Because that goes against the principle of what Gideon V. Wainwright did, which was provide public defenders like me to people who can't afford it. The public defender's office here in Utah, do some homework. Go look at how much the prosecutor's office makes, their budget versus the public defender's office. There is an inequality. And the other thing I want to say on public defenders is that, you know, they say that, you know, public defenders need more money, we need more public defenders, but, you know, what I want you to do is go back to why we need public defenders. It's because poor people are charged with crimes. Why are poor people, what kind of crimes are they charged with? Drug crimes. There's a whole systematic thing that that people fail to look at when we talk about public defenders. You know, I want to make more money. I didn't go to law school to make money, but I would love to make more money. But, you know, think about why we need more public defenders. It's because we have an unjust system. And, you know.
And it's not just the number of public defenders. It's also the resources they have.
Yeah.
When the state gets ready to prosecute, they have investigators. Mm-hmm. They have state labs to do tests. They have other things. Those are generally not available to public defenders. Investigators are extremely rare. Money to have expert tests done have to be held very tight because it's just not enough to go around. When you start balancing all those resources, then you start to see that the system is not as balanced as the ideal is. The ideal is the state must prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The Supreme Court in Gideon said, fairness requires an equal playing field. But the field is not equal. It's, again, better than it was 50 years ago. But it's not equal yet.
Let me ask this follow-up question to Jesse. Jesse, you work for the Salt Lake Legal Defender Association, and I worked there for 18, 20 years, so I know what occurs there and so forth, so your answer will be tested by somebody who has experience with the public defender's office.
Let's go.
It has been identified as the Cadillac of public defender office, but it only serves Salt Lake County. What do you see is the impact of having a public defender office such as the Salt Lake Legal Defender Office in all areas of Utah? What impact would that have on equality for all areas of Utah?
Yeah. The Salt Lake Legal Defenders Association, I really wanted to work there. And now that I have a job there, it is really the best job in the world. They are, I work with some of the greatest defense attorneys there are. These are committed, hardworking people that want to defend the rights of our clients. I would say they're better than a Cadillac, more of like a Aston Martin of sorts, because they are a great office. If every defendant in Utah who's charged with a crime that could not afford an attorney got the representation of the Salt Lake Public Defender's Office, they would be well served. I've had clients come up to me. I introduce myself. Hi, I'm Jesse Nix. I'm your attorney. And they go, are you part of the public pretender's office? No, you know, I'm a public defender and I'm going to help you out. The problem is in these rural areas of Utah, like Judge Thorne said, they are contract. Now, I'm not going to speak to the level of representation those contract attorneys give, but, you know, I would like to see a system where if you are in Vernal, Utah, if you are in Panguitch, if you are in St. George, you get the representation that you deserve. And that's what I think my office provides.
And the fact that it's publicly funded doesn't necessarily mean that it fits the image that's on TV of public defenders. The image of public defenders on TV is, as Jesse just said, pretenders. I can't tell you the number of times on a trial bench when privately retained counsel moved in on a case that public defenders had been appointed on. And I'm thinking, you realize you're giving up a Class A attorney for a Class C attorney. Public defenders in Salt Lake County, are really at the top tier. There are outstanding private criminal defense attorneys as well. But the top third of the practitioners in criminal defense work include all the public defenders, and that's not the case, again, in many places in the country.
Thank you. Why is it important? We've talked about the importance of having competent representations for all, well, in criminal cases, for all defendants. Let me broaden that a little bit and ask, why is it important to have legal professionals such as yourselves, including attorneys, paralegals, clerks, et cetera, in the legal system from, or actually in any professional career from different ethnic backgrounds? Why is it important to have legal professionals, including attorneys, judges, paralegals, clerks from different ethnic backgrounds? Grace?
Well, I think that anyone who is different than you has a different view on the world and can bring a new idea to the table that maybe you had not considered. I spent most of my summers traveling to Uruguay when I was a kid, and I remember as a 12-year-old talking politics with foreign nationals who have a much better grasp on it than I did as a 12-year-old American. And they were talking to me about foreign policies of the United States, and I was like, what are they talking about? They knew so much more than I did, and it made me come back and, you know, have a critical eye to the news, critical eye to newspapers, and recognize that they saw the world differently than me. And suddenly, I saw the world differently than my peers. Well, when you engage people from different backgrounds, whether it be they're from an impoverished background, they were raised non-Mormon, they were raised Mormon, they were raised fundamental Mormon, they were raised Southern Baptist, they were raised gay or lesbian, they lived in Europe. All those people have a different view of the world. And I find that the more people that I bring into the table, they have creative solutions, they have a new way of looking at things that maybe I hadn't thought of before, and I just find that contribution to be invaluable. And so I think one of the things that I think we have overcome through time is in recognizing that equality is a goal, but diversity is a goal too. And I used to always argue, you know, I want to make a job because of me, not because I'm a female, not because I'm a minority. But as I've aged, now I'm the ripe age of 41, I'm starting to recognize, well, that is me. Okay, I am a minority, I am a woman, I have a different perspective, and that value is intrinsic. So I think one of the things that we're evolving to is recognizing diversity for the sake of diversity has value. And I think that value comes from a different viewpoint.
Yeah, and the value is not at the end of the numbers, just saying I have so many of this, and I have so many of that, and I have so many of this. Diversity is really a problem-solving strategy. It's not about political correctness. It's about a problem-solving strategy. When you're standing at the top of the mountain and you look out into the valley looks very different than when you're standing in the valley looking around. Reality hasn't changed, but what you see of it has changed. If we're going to solve problems, if you could solve them by yourself, you would have done it. The fact that we can't solve problems, that there are so many intractable problems in our communities, means that one person, one group couldn't solve those problems. But if you can get the perspective of other points of view, you can triangulate on what the problem is. The solution is not the property of any one group, but when you can get groups and perspectives to change and share perspectives, you can identify the problem, and then you can try and address those problems. So I think that's the first value of diversity. Is a problem-solving strategy, not a goal in and of itself. But the second part is, I think it's so important when a young person can walk in a courtroom and see somebody like themselves and not be surprised, to know that that system belongs to them and to people like them. That doesn't mean every person should have a judge who fits their perspective, but that when you walk in a courtroom, it shouldn't surprise you that there is somebody like you or somebody different than you, and that you can have then a trust that that system of justice belongs to you and you have a place in it.
Yeah, the first line of the Constitution is we the people. Focus on we. And a lot of the times I think my clients step into the courtroom and they're thinking them the people. You know, these are majority white people. My judge is white. The prosecutor's white. My public pretender is white. This system is against me. This is not we the people. And I think Judge Thorne is absolutely correct. When I have clients who walk into a courtroom and they sit down with me, I have my black hair. You can tell I'm a little bit ethnic, not too much, unfortunately. But they I am able to relate with them from my experiences from my mother, who emigrated here. English was not her first language. I take all the experiences of having a mother who I saw treated terribly by people because she didn't speak English, because she didn't understand something the first time. And I sit down with my clients and I explain things. And I am able to have an empathetic view towards them about where what they're charged with, what the solution to their problem is, what treatment they should be getting. And that's why we have diversity. So I can help solve a problem that other people can't. The business community does this. The business community has, you know, if you think of Zions Bank or any big corporation, they have, you know, an Asian or a Hispanic or an LGBT group that, you know, they want to make money. They want to have solutions. And by having people in the court that look like you, you'll be able to relate. And then you walk out of that courtroom. I've had clients thank a judge. You know, they get sentenced. You know, you're sentenced to this jail period. And they say, thank you. You know, and and that's what we need to strive for, because they feel like justice was served. You know, they were guilty, justice is served, rather than having a judge that they don't relate with, and they walk out of that courtroom feeling bad.
Justice in a democracy really depends on two things: actual fairness and the appearance of fairness. It doesn't work if the system looks fair but really isn't. And it doesn't work if it really is fair, but it doesn't look like it's fair. In a democracy, we need fairness and the appearance of fairness.
And I think perception is very important. I know that when I meet someone and they find out that I speak Spanish, or that I can understand them, or that I have, even I'm from Alabama, it's a different, it's a whole little subculture into itself, that I can relate to people as well. It opens up a bridge between the two of us that makes them see me as human, me see them as human, that really does work. And I know that the courtrooms are very intimidating. Have you guys walked down to the courthouse and just walked in? It's intimidating. It's a very alien place. There are people that belong there, people that don't belong there, people that know what they're doing. And can you imagine if you have been in custody and suddenly come into the courtroom and you're drug in there and your name is called, how intimidating that would be if you felt as if everyone was different than you and no one could relate to you at all. And I often think about one of our constitutional rights is to be judged by a jury of our peers, and that's supposed to be representative of the population. And I always wonder, well, why doesn't that also apply to the bench? And I'm not saying exact numbers, so we have 20% population Asian, we have 20% Asian judges. That's not what I mean. But at least the opportunity for a person that comes in from the community to say, these judges represent my community, or at least a representative of what I see when I walk down the street as well. And I think that has value that can't be discounted.
Thank you. Speaking of diversity then also, as the panelists know, case law has established that under the Sixth Amendment's guarantee of an impartial jury and the 14th Amendment's right to equal protection of the laws, a person has a right to a jury trial or to a jury of his or her peers. In other words, a jury that is truly representative of one's community and made up of a fair cross-section of the community. Furthermore, the case law holds that the systematic exclusion of jurors based on race or gender is, quote, at war with our basic concepts of a democratic society and a representative government. Utah's Hispanic, Polynesian, African American, and other minority populations have increased substantially in the recent years. First question is the right to a jury of one's peers being met in our courtrooms today? Secondly, why? And thirdly, if that constitutional requirement is not being met, what changes do you suggest to improve this? Jesse, you've done jury trials. That's your job.
Yep.
Do you see as far as the meeting of the requirement for having a jury of one's peers in our courtrooms today?
So my office represents people that can't afford attorneys, and it turns out lots of those people are racial minorities. And so I've had, when I was practicing the Salt Lake City Justice Court, I was always intrigued to see what my juries would look like. And most of them all looked white. A lot of them were LDS, and I could tell because they jurors turn in forms, and I can see you kind of figure it out. And so I would have my client sitting to my right, who was maybe undocumented, maybe, you know, brown, Latino, black. I mean, I've had them all. And they have this jury in front of them, it's white. I think that's a problem. But the way to overcome that is when I talk to a jury, I remind them that we are all citizens under the law. We all have the same goals. We all want the goals of justice and equality. So the fact that they don't look like my defendants, I think, is less problematic than if someone is on my jury and they believe that my client's guilty just because they're sitting there. I wish the jury's members, you know, reflected the more makeup of the community. I don't know why most of my juries in Salt Lake City were mostly white. I can't speak to that, but I have been successful in convincing them that, you know, proof beyond a reasonable doubt is absolutely the essential of our criminal justice system, and get not guilties for my clients. So,
Judge Thorne?
I had a chance to meet with a group of fifth graders yesterday, and I was talking with them about jurors and juries making decisions, that it wasn't just people in black robes, it wasn't just government officials who make decisions, but it was community people. And I tried to explain to them why it was important to have a jury of your peers. And I told them about a poster that my daughter, who's a teacher, had seen, where it was a dog that was on trial, and the jury was eight cats. And then you'd ask them, is this fair? Even as fifth graders, they could understand that that's not fair. And again, I believe that our system depends on fairness and the appearance of fairness. So the fact that Jesse can get a jury of whoever shows up to agree that this defendant needs to be protected, that means the system may actually work. But the other half of the equation is it has to look fair, so that when people walk in the courtroom, they have confidence that the system will work for them, that they've been heard and they've been understood. It's my experience as a trial judge that people can take a verdict against them if they thought the people who made the decision listened and understood their point of view. But when they walk out and say, those people had nothing in common with me, those people did not understand what I was talking about, and they had their minds made up, even if the system is fair, it doesn't look fair, and that's not a good sign for democracy.
Thank you. Let me ask this question of Grace, and other panelists can express their views as well, but I'm going to ask you, or throw you this softball, Grace, especially since it may appear that somebody who might have a say in whether you get more money or not in your profession is sitting in the audience. Statistics from the Institute of Women's Policy Research indicate that women make up half of the workforce and receive more college and graduate degrees than men today. However, on average, women continue to earn considerably less than men. These same statistics suggest that in 2010, women full-time workers made only 77 cents on every dollar owned by men. This is a gender wage gap of 23%. In your profession as an attorney here in Utah, do you see this same phenomenon? And if you do, what things have contributed to this occurring?
I do see it. I see that women have a harder time in this profession. Being a lawyer is a tough job. Mainly because it's a very demanding job. We work a lot of hours, and it's a business. And so it's all about the numbers that you bring in. I see that mothers especially have a difficult time in my profession because there's inherent bias. And actually, I was involved in a program where they did an initiative on the advancement and retention of women in law firms in the state of Utah. This came out in 2010, so it's old now, and it was old then, actually, because the results were from several years earlier, that looked into this problem. And what they determined was that whether people knew it or not, there were inherent biases against women. They perceived women as either putting their family first or not being as committed as men. Interestingly enough, the mistakes women make are more noted than mistakes that men make. Women have to prove that they're competent where men are presumed to be competent. These basic things that seem very small really have a dramatic effect in the advancement of women within law firms. There are statistics actually in Utah in 2010 that the number of minority female law partners in this state, and that would include me because I'm a female minority law partner, was 0.4%. Not even 1% of all law partners in this state were minority women, which is amazing. But nationwide, it's only 2%, so it's not like we're too far off the mark. And women in Utah, only 11% of the women lawyers in this state are actually partners in a law firm, even though we make up about 50% of the actual graduates from law school. So there is a problem there, and it's a perception problem. And whenever I mentor young women, because I try to, I think I have a moral obligation, by the way, to mentor women and minorities in this profession to try to understand a way to succeed. It's part of my obligation, I think, as a lawyer and as a human being, is I always tell them that you don't have to be a man, but you have to think like a man, and you have to be able to communicate like a man, because the things that you may find important and may actually be very relevant to the resolution of your case, to communicating with your clients, may not necessarily work when communicating with other male lawyers. And so I've been adaptive in the way that I communicate with men, communicate with my clients, understanding that there are differences between the genders. But we're a lot alike, too. And some of those differences should be celebrated rather than seen as our limitations. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I hope that
Thank
does.
Thank you. That is great. Yeah. We have a few minutes left, and rather than ask more questions, I'm going to ask the people in the audience if any of you have any questions for our panel members.
Yeah, and if you do have a question, please just state your name and something about yourself into the microphone.
I'm Aaron Young. I'm a mining student. I was just curious about what you mentioned, how the public defenders in the state do really well. And I was just wondering if public defenders was subsidized by the government, how their performance might be affected.
So the public defenders, we receive county funding. So we are one of two states that, you know, the taxpayers of Salt Lake County fund the Salt Lake County Public Defender's Office, which means that the taxpayers in St. George or in, I don't know all the 29 counties, but in those counties, they fund the Public Defender's Office. But because there's not a full-time Public Defender's Office besides, I think, Utah County and Salt Lake County, they're, like Judge Thorne said, low big contracts. The government, which is in the business of making things cheap, keeping things cheap, you know, an attorney says, "Oh, I'll do the caseload for, you know, X amount of money," and so what happens is the county says, "Okay, do it for that less amount of money," but the problem with doing that way is that, for instance, I have no private clients. I only represent people through my office. But outside of Utah County and Salt Lake County, you have private attorneys that are contracted with the county. So they have their own clients, and then they have the public defender clients. Now, who's making the more money, right? Private clients. And so one of the problems, and the ACLU did a study on this about public defense in Utah, the problem is that these lawyers spend more time with their private attorney, with their private clients, because they're getting thousands of dollars, versus their public defender clients. And that's where we get the idea of public pretenders, or all my public defender wants to do is plead me out. Because honestly, it's easier to plead someone out than go to trial and fight for their rights. Does that answer your question?
Okay. There's also an editorial in the Salt Lake Tribune this morning about the need to provide more public funding for public defenders.
But remember, there's a system that has created the number of crimes that public defenders have to go against. So if there's one way to save money, it's to decriminalize crimes that are illegal right now.
My name is Sean Harris, and I'm a political science and information systems major. And I have a unique perspective because I've actually found myself on the wrong side of the bench a couple times in my younger years. And one thing I noticed is that there are states that take more of a community corrections approach when you're sentencing somebody, but Utah really doesn't. And I look at Idaho, for example, and they have what they call a rider where you go to, you're under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections for 60 to 180 days, and then you come back and you're on parole or probation. Do you think a program like that would work better, would work in Utah to not only help decrease the prison population, but reduce Utah's notoriously high recidivism rate?
I guess I don't quite understand your question, so I'd have a few follow-ups. So here in Utah, you would go to jail for a number of days, and then you can be put on probation.
Well, this is like prison light. So you go to a Idaho Department of Corrections facility. It's called a rider or a retainer.
So it's not a prison or a jail.
It is a prison.
Okay.
So I'm sentenced. I get put on retained jurisdiction. I go through the inmate orientation process where you're checked in. You are an inmate of the Idaho Department of Corrections. And then after you've successfully completed the treatment, you're released back on probation or parole. Or yeah. Probation, and then the judge retains jurisdiction.
Okay.
They've seen a decrease of about 30% in the recidivism rate because they have that program.
Yes, of course. I mean, in Utah, we recently cut funding, I believe, to inmates in the Utah State Prison. There used to be educational programs. I can't speak to if there are now, but I know that the legislature, you know, defunded some of that. And logically think about that. You have these people who get into, you know, they've done something bad. Now they're in prison. So rather than just locking the key and throwing it away, let's get them education. Let's get them substance abuse help. Let's get them all the help they need. And then when they transition out, let's not just drop them. Let's make sure that there's a way to have them reintegrate into society. Because a lot of my clients, once they get out of jail, you know what they do? Well, now they're felons, so they have a hard time getting a job or housing. So they need money, but no one will hire them. So you know what's an easy way to get some money? Start selling drugs. And then they start selling drugs, and what happens? They go back to jail, you know? Rehabilitation should be the number one goal of our criminal justice system, you know? Rehabilitation and punishment. But I think we need to focus on the rehabilitation more, or else we're just going to have repeat offenders.
And this is where I think a little diversity on the prosecution side, a diversity in the police force would actually be beneficial. I've actually lived in like Alabama, Nebraska, California, and here, and so I've never seen prosecutors like I've seen in Utah. Like I see people be prosecuted, I'm like, for what? What did they prosecute you for? The craziest crimes, and it all stems from a moral standpoint. If it has to do with sex or drugs or alcohol, there's a zero tolerance for it. And so it causes a lot of, I've seen my clients come in and tell me they're losing their kids because of this, and I'm like, really? Where I know in other states that wouldn't be viewed as stringently. And so I built, not that one's right or wrong, it's just that I think that there's a lack of perspective or a lack of real-life understanding mm-hmm. of the world by some of the people that are prosecuting the crimes and that the police officers, and I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for saying that, I'm sure. But I really believe it's true. I think if they had a little bit more real-life experience, maybe had gotten in trouble as a youth, went on to college, became a productive member of society, then when they have a child that is in front of them that committed a crime, they don't put them in juvie and throw away the key, but they maybe put them in a program that helps them not sell drugs and teach them a skill. So,
I'll give you an example. So DUI laws in Utah are some of the strictest, right? And so who's making these DUI laws? The state legislature, which has mandated what judges can and can't do. You know, so the driver's license division on a first DUI will take away your license for 120 days, which means that someone who's charged with a DUI, just charged, not found guilty, has their license taken away for 120 days. Well, now, if that person doesn't have access to public transportation, and I've had clients like this, they lose their job. And what happens when they lose their job? You know, they can't feed their family. There are these collateral consequences that happen because we're more focused on punishing the crime rather than saying, okay, you may have drank too much. Do you have an alcohol problem? Let's fix that.
Judge Thorne, you were a circuit court judge in your early years. And I know you probably notice a difference in the programs available then than now. Now we have evidence-based sentencing, drug courts, mental health courts, and so forth. Are those changes that you see come about from when you were a circuit court judge, a trial-level judge, I won't say many years ago.
Even though it was.
Compared to today.
There have been steps forward that are extremely positive. Rehabilitation courts, healing courts, the drug courts, I mean, the data that comes from those is just absolutely clear.
And even the Utah legislature recognizes that drug courts are a success. They cut down on the recidivism. They return people to be healthy members of the community that can support their families. One of the things that we need to remember is that unless we're going to lock somebody up for life, they're going to get out and they're going to be our neighbors. What's the thing that we can do to help them become good neighbors? If we simply lock people up and throw away the key, that really is, in my mind, the essence of graduate school for crime. What we need to do is be providing the things that Jesse was talking about, the things that you just mentioned, the mental health courts. When the Supreme Court made the decision that we could not lock people up for mental illness, which absolutely is a humane decision, what happened was they got thrown out of the jails onto the streets. And then they got in trouble for minor offenses and got locked up again, rather than using the resources to try and fix the problem. And part of this, understand, is not just my background in the circuit courts, but I was a tribal court judge for many years before that. And in tribal communities, you don't have a lot of resources. And we used to gather people together and talk about how can we fix this person? How can we make things available so that they don't come back? Because they were our relatives. They were our neighbors. They had people in their families who had problems. And their goal was not to lock them up and put them away. Their goal was to try and help fix them so they could become a healthy member of the community. There are steps that are moving in that direction. But we need to do much more of that. And while we're doing the drug courts at the front end, the programs at the prison that Jesse's talking about are absolutely disappearing. It used to be that the greatest single factor for recidivism was literacy, just the ability to read so that they could fill out a job application, so that they could follow basic instructions and read manuals to operate equipment. So what happens is the literacy programs get cut.
Thank you. I understand our time is up. I want to thank the panelists for being here today and their thoughtful and insightful comments, and for you listening to what they have presented.
Thank you.